inform my approach to healthcare. Well, when I moved to Toronto for my PharmD degree, 2011, 12, and 13, it was January 2012, my mom Zoom called me, and I was just excited to talk to her, and she's like, well, your dad got fired. And I was like, what? Like, he was there for almost 20 years in this place as a manager at our arena in Saskatoon. And it was just random. He was fired and charged with fraud and told to go home and don't even take anything from your office. And we're like, what? I mean, very long story short, he won his legal case later because he did absolutely nothing wrong. But what this did to our family was just so profound. No longer was my dad putting into retirement and collecting money. He was pulling from his retirement. It put us into a huge financial struggle. And this comes after earlier in life, both of my parents declaring bankruptcy twice, to the point where we had to live in a trailer in my grandparents' driveway in Saskatoon. But going through this, witnessing my family go through this was extremely challenging. Then what I described to be as perhaps the most challenging, if not maybe the second most challenging part of my life, was my younger sister's experience with pain. It was labeled as chronic pain basically right away, but we're like, it's only started today, so this isn't chronic. She basically had chronic acute pain. She would be screaming at the top of her lungs for like truly 6 to 8 hours every day. We had police called to our house thinking someone was being murdered or someone's being abused there, and it was just her in pain. She was formerly at spin classes every day, going to nursing school, and then she could no longer speak. In fact, we couldn't even hug her because of the sensitization of her nervous system. One time my dad just dropped a pillow down on the couch and the air from it just made her start screaming. Nobody believed her about her pain. We just all described this sense of wanting to be out on our front lawn and be like, can somebody help us? Like, who can believe us? Nobody was helping us. The people we'd get referred to over and over and over would say, I don't think anything is wrong with her. She should stop all meds and try meditation and maybe Tylenol. And like, it was wild. Anyway, that's another independent, very long story, but it lasted about 4 to 5 years. And during this time, we all withdrew from society, like much of my life until that point, completely withdrawn from society. When my dad was embarrassed in that way in the small city of Saskatoon, only 300,000, but withdrew from society, this was so, so, so difficult for all of us. After she finally found a point where she could care for herself and found a truly life-saving surgery that she got in Florida, which was hundreds of thousands US dollars. Meanwhile, my dad not working from being fired, and my goodness, a lot there. But during the first few months of the pandemic, I mean, this was a challenge for everybody, but I'm just going to talk about its challenge to me for this moment. I realized during that time how I had created a life around myself that was so busy and so full of stuff that I didn't have to think about my own stuff or who I was or who I am. And being by myself in my little condo in Saskatoon for 3 months, I just like couldn't do it anymore. Up until that point, I had promised myself that I would always live a life as a cis straight man. And a single cis straight man, because I couldn't see a life, it was not modeled for me, that I would ever have a relationship with a woman who would be understanding and okay with the fact that I had experimented with those few men. And I just told myself this narrative, well, nothing's ever going to work with anybody, so it's just going to be me, myself, and I accepted that. But having to live like that for those 3 months was, oh my gosh, I can't do this anymore. But I still couldn't see how I'd live as myself in Saskatoon, in Saskatchewan, in my pharmacy discipline. It was just not modeled for me. There was a lot of homophobia, still is, in my family. So I was fearful that I would be kind of ostracized from my family. I decided to Zoom my parents. I was like, I think I'm just going to do this right now. right now. I'm like, before I change my mind, I'm just gonna ask them to get on Zoom. I'll send them a link, and I just dumped a whole lot on them. I told them about everything that happened in elementary school and high school and all of those parts of my identity that I either hid, all the things I didn't tell them about, the bullying. It was just rather wild. And I wore a Schitt's Creek t-shirt because Schitt's Creek changed my life. That was the first time that I really felt like I was reflected in media. I saw so much of myself, and still do, in David Rose. I couldn't believe it. And it was modeled to me that, yeah, he's maybe mostly into men, but you know what? There's an occasional woman or a rosé that used to be a Chardonnay. And if you know the wine scene, it told me like, oh my gosh, maybe I can just like be Jairus, and whatever I do is whatever I do. Like, profound concept. Holy. So that was very intentional that I wore the Schitt's Creek t-shirt, but just absolutely came out to my family, and what a weight off that was. But it also made some of my worst fears come true. My brother-in-law told me that, oh, good for you. When someone lives as themselves, nobody can hurt them, and said some what might appear to be nice things. But my response back to him was like, thank you, I appreciate that. However, I think that living as your true self, people absolutely can and do still hurt you. And I must let you know that so much of why it's taken me until this point, I was 34, this was 5 years ago, I'm only 39 right now. I said much of why I was not going to do it at all, and much of why it took me this long, was because I was worried I wouldn't be allowed to see my nieces and nephews anymore. With this whole narrative for a lot of folks, but especially what I saw replicated a lot in Saskatchewan of you're a pedophile, right? If you're a gay man, you're a pedophile. After sharing that with him that day, my nieces and nephews were all told to block and delete me, and I didn't speak with them for 2 years. And I was by myself in my condo. I talked to them every day. I gave both of my nephews a car. I tutored both of my nephews every day, whether in person or over the phone or Zoom. It's just completely ruptured my relationship with my five nieces and nephews, which is why it's been so much easier to move to Toronto, where I am now, versus Saskatoon. So I felt like I lost what little bit of family I had left, and it was really just my family that I had, right? I didn't have that strong social circle. The social circle I did have, like those men at the football game, Super Bowl, that we were watching together, I was even worried too, like, are they going to still want to be my friends? I don't know what to do. And even my best friends, when I tell them this, I feel like then I've been lying to them my whole life. So am I their best friend? Are they my best friend? Like, it was just a wow. The things that queer folks go through is remarkable, and it's just so challenging. Then I went on Tinder. After being an out person in Saskatoon in September 2020, and went on one date with one guy who later became my partner of a year. So I dated him for a whole year, and it was just really wild. But also, I never really experienced true dating because the world was shut down, right? We were only allowed for much of our year together, one contact in person. So it was just him and I, and not anybody else that I was allowed to see. For many reasons, it didn't work out. I've since learned from many other book authors who write about queer relationships and gay men. They were like, your first relationship as a gay man is never going to work out. So I'm like, okay, well, now I don't feel as bad. But it didn't. I was very upset. That was my first relationship, period. Never mind with a guy. I had not actually had a partner prior to him. So I was very upset, and I went home to my family, like stayed at their place instead of my condo, and slept the night there. And then, of course, the very next day, my mom got diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. So there was just no break, right? Meanwhile, my sister's still recovering from her pain. Meanwhile, my dad is still off work. My relationship just ended the day before. Still not allowed to see my nieces and nephews. And now my mom has to go through chemotherapy. The person who I was so worried about dying for my entire life. During the same time, being an Indigenous person, a two-spirit person, a queer person in pharmacy and academia had proved to be impossible. And I shied away from saying specific things for too long, but I'm not doing that anymore. The University of Saskatchewan was absolutely terrible. It was horrific. I don't recommend any Indigenous student or faculty or staff go there, truly. I said to them in this whole process, what I would love to be able to do is recommend Indigenous students, staff, and faculty apply there. They should be able to apply there. There's so many Indigenous folks in that area, in that community. What a better spot for them to go. But you haven't shown me any reason why that this would be an okay thing for them to do. My experience as an Indigenous human, never mind Indigenous pharmacist or professor, and being a young person, I think those all those intersecting identities came together in a way that I was just completely not taken seriously, ever. In fact, my dean, the first dean of two who I had there, in professional settings like this, like often it was like an evening student-run event or something, and several of my colleagues would go, hundreds of my students would be there, and my dean would introduce people like, hey, we're so lucky to have our faculty here tonight. Dr. Taylor is here, Dr. Blackburn, Dr. Shevchuk, Jarris, same degrees. Jarris, oh, but you know, Jarris isn't so much of a professor, he's more of a pretty boy. And then I was introduced as pretty boy each time thereafter while my colleagues were doctor. After being there for a year, my dean came into my office and just sat down, shut the door and was like, okay, Jarris, the faculty is going to figure out a way to tone down our promotion of your accomplishments. And I'm like, okay, like, sure, sounds good. Like, why? And they did. So we were in a faculty where anytime someone would get a grant or there'd be a news article or something worth celebrating, an email would go out to the whole faculty. It would go in our newsletters, maybe the like screens, TV screens in the hallways. But that completely stopped for me for the rest of my time there. They even moved my office. So pharmacy was on one wing of the third floor of the health sciences building at the University of Saskatchewan, and it still is. And then I was moved to the other wing of the fourth floor in the middle of nursing. So I wasn't even around my colleagues anymore. In a meeting with just my dean, my next dean after him, and my associate dean research, I experienced some of the most remarkable racism I ever had by that point. During our conversations, my associate dean research said, you know, Jarris, I'm just going to say, when the First Nations came over here, and I was like, yeah, I'm glad to see some wide eyes. So like, thank you. Why couldn't you have been there with me? But I was like, whoa, 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 I'll stop you right there. Like, we didn't come over here. And he goes, oh, like, you actually believe that? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, oh, so you think you've been here since the dinosaurs? That's not what I said. So do you think God just went poof and there you are? No, not what I'm saying. So where did you come from, Jarris? The soil? I'm like, where did you come from? I actually said that by that point. I was so frustrated. And then during the course of that conversation, when I was talking about access to care for Indigenous peoples, our access to our ceremonies, our access to our traditional medicines and whatnot, and how difficult it was, my dean now contributes to the conversation, never stopped it before, and she says, well, you know, Jarris, if you can't go to a sweat lodge, you can just go sit in the sauna in your gym. So this continued in such profound ways at every level of that institution for so long, I just couldn't believe it. I was obsessed with my job. I was so excited to work there. I bragged about my colleagues all the time. My mom was like, I don't understand why this is happening to you. Every day you'd come home and be like, wow, my colleague got this. I feel so cool and like lucky to work with them. Like, I know. Like, what happened? I don't know what I did. I just was hated, absolutely hated. When I had a long braid for a while, my dean came up to me as I was talking to students in the hallway and he just interrupted, Jarris, what's up with your hair? I liked it better before. Another program director, oh, I bet that was intentional. I'm like, what? And they're pointing to my hair. I'm like, oh, they're like really looking the part, hey? It was rampant. I couldn't take it anymore. When I asked, like, where can a complaint be made, my faculty got together and told my one ally, and that faculty who I thought was my ally, oh, yeah, there is a mechanism for him to complain, but don't tell him. The provost threatened me to file a report, file a complaint. It led to a five-year-long investigation from an external investigator who's white with 3 degrees from that university, only interviewed white people, used to teach at that university, and her email signature said, "Go Huskies," which is that university's sports team, even though she worked for herself in this external independent investigation. So last Christmas, my first ever Christmas alone and in Toronto by myself, I had 2 weeks to read 315 single space type pages about how horrible I am. In that whole investigation, they found that I've just been this master manipulator. I need to be the center of all kinds of attention. If any time another Indigenous person was around, I'd leave. That comment, too, was about indigenizing standards for promotion and tenure. I was on a working group for the university-wide to look at the nature of Indigenous academics' work. We do stuff differently. So how do we adjudicate their files when it comes to promotion and tenure? We did that work for 3 years, and then every faculty and department had to make it their own. And at that same time, my faculty said, like, "Jairus, you're on way too many committees," which I absolutely was. They said, "You need to focus on promotion and tenure, focus on your research, focus on your teaching, no more committees. You're not allowed to say yes to any more, and you also need to get off of some." So I said, "Okay, sounds good." Then when the call went out for volunteers for indigenizing promotion and tenure standards in the Faculty of Pharmacy, I didn't volunteer. What do they do? You know, it's a real shame that you didn't put your name forward for this. It's just like, okay, then I'll do it. Like this constantly happens. I'm fine, I'll do it. The first two meetings, nobody ever even picked up a pen. They were just drilling me, like, why do you need this? We've had standards since the beginning of academia, and it seems to be working pretty well. What would go in your file, Jairus? Your number of Twitter followers? That was also the dinosaur comment guy. In the same era of time, I finally named white supremacy in pharmacy. I don't mean white supremacists. I mean white supremacy, epistemic racism, the privileging of knowledge systems, of whiteness, Western knowledge systems, over everything else, including indigeneity. When I had tweeted about white supremacy in the education and profession of pharmacy, that associate dean emailed me within 2 hours, he's not even on Twitter, and said I was an embarrassment to the faculty, that he doesn't feel safe working around me, that I've essentially called him and all my colleagues KKK members and skinheads. He kicked me off every grad student committee that I was on because I was now deemed as not safe to be around. I left. I did not have anything else in front of me. I had geared up my life to be a pharmacy professor. I was so happy with where I was, and I wanted to stay in Saskatoon. This was my home community, right? I tried everything to stay there, and it just couldn't happen. I didn't even have a job interview lined up, and I just resigned. It's not worth it because I am fearful for my life here. I could not continue to exist there. I became so unhappy. And when I look at pictures of myself at that time, I can see how my physical nature changed. I could no longer see myself in the mirror. I just didn't know, like, what was going on. What am I doing? Like, who am I? Literally, I'm a new out queer person, two-spirit person who's been totally ostracized from their profession. What I thought were my life goals and dreams, clearly I can't achieve these, and especially not here in Saskatoon. Didn't know what the step forward was. And then, of course, the most challenging part of all was watching my mom go through this. My story is not just my own, though, and how it has shaped my approach to healthcare really comes intergenerationally, too. Both my grandmother and great-grandmother, as I mentioned, or as was mentioned in the bio, attended residential schools. They went to Gordon Indian Residential School, which was the last one to close in Canada, in Saskatchewan, in 1996, when I was 10. And some of my friends who are my age did go there until they were 10. That's where they went. This is a picture of Gordon Indian Residential School. And this, of course, affected such... Well, everybody, really every Indigenous person in this country has been affected by it, whether they or a direct family member went or not. We've all been affected by it. even in the first few moments of going to the residential school, it was completely traumatic. Your hair was cut, boy or girl, and there was only boy or girl, according to the schools. Your hair was cut. When my great-grandfather's hair was cut, when his braids were cut one time, when he was jumped walking home with his groceries, he didn't even speak for 6 months. He was so traumatized by that. They are our connection to the spirit world. The longer our braids are, the more connected we are to the earth. Before you learn how to braid your own hair, someone else is doing it for you. There's ceremony in that. There's relationality. You're building a strong relationship with a sibling, a parent, an aunt, an uncle, someone. You're being given teachings about your culture when your hair is being braided. It's a huge part. So much so that when someone dies, for example, we often will cut our hair as like a symbol of mourning or as an act of mourning. So they didn't even have to spend a day there and experience trauma that would last a lifetime. Many of them, like my grandmother and great-grandmother, were not allowed to leave during the school year. And even if they were, sometimes they didn't want to, because they were just told to the rest of the time in school that their ancestors, their family, are dirty and belong in hell. Even shown pictures of heaven and hell with like white angels at the top and then like blackened, dark colored like devils right in the bottom, and saying, this is your family, but you need to be up here, to the point where some of them like scrubbed their skin so hard when they're cleansing to try to have lighter skin. They didn't want to have dark skin anymore. They didn't want to be down there. They wanted to be up there, like they were told during school. But their families wanted to be close to them, so they just set up camps, right, just to simply be close to their children. Lots of the stats we've been told are wrong. This is wrong. This was based on an estimate of approximately 3,000-ish children dying during residential schools, and I'll repeat, this is a school, or it was supposed to be. So your odds of dying were said to be higher than serving in World War II, but by the time we had only searched 11 of the over 130 school grounds in Canada, over 10,000 bodies have been discovered. What they went through, even if they survived, this was around them constantly too. There is no arguing the fact that Canadian government policies are absolutely to blame for the current state of Indigenous people's health. In fact, that's Truth and Reconciliation Commission Call to Action 18. The first of 7 related to health, just acknowledging that the current state of our health is related to Canadian government policies. I always want to recognize and affirm the difficulties and challenges and traumas in so many people's lives, but often, you know, unlike this, often it's not because of your elected politician. It's something else going on in your family dynamic. These were our elected politicians, provincially and nationally, who did this. We were experimented on in residential schools. We would go to jail if we farmed using anything other than our bare hands, whereas white settlers could use their bare hands. The Indian Act had this official amendment, the peasant farming policy. It was illegal for us to hire lawyers, and if anyone wanted to help us get a lawyer or raise money for us to get a lawyer, they would go to jail too. We could not even stand up for ourselves in a court of law. We couldn't even vote until the country was almost 100. There's a whole myth of meritocracy. There's a fantastic paper by Sheila McLean. She's a white anti-racist scholar and great friend of mine who co-founded the Idle No More movement. She has a 2-page paper called We Came Here From Nothing. I think every person in this country should read it, but she highlights how there's this national narrative of newcomer families, basically folks who were not the first peoples, like my Ukrainian family, for example, of we came to Canada with nothing. And they actually did. Their boat capsized when they were coming here from the Ukraine. But what Sheila outlines is, okay, maybe you came here with nothing, but you had a vote. You had support in times of famine. We had starvation, forced starvation until we'd sign a treaty. You had representation in government. We, again, couldn't even vote, so no representation. You could sell wheat freely and goods. We could not. We'd go to jail for using anything other than our bare hands. And she highlights all of this, that, okay, yeah, maybe you started from nothing, but there was every opportunity there, right? So what is created is this myth of meritocracy when people see Indigenous folks like, well, if my family came here with literally nothing other than the clothes on our back and we are now lawyers and dentists, why can't you? Right? It's the source of so many of our ongoing issues in this country. And then in healthcare, Indian hospitals, which remained open until 1981, I was only born 5 years after that. The education system on reserves were funded between $2,000 and $8,000 less per child on reserve than a similar student would be funded in a city like Kingston or Toronto or Saskatoon. I've found that most people have heard of most of, or at least some of that, but what I've found in my journey thus far is very few knew about the 60 Scoop. And again, another government policy, which is exactly why we are where we are in terms of our health outcomes right now and on a continual basis in Canada. So I've always asked, why don't health professionals know about this? We were basically sold. In fact, below the colonial border, we were sold. If you gave $10 or more to a priest, and certainly if you gave more, he'd give you your choice of a good one, of a good First Nations or Métis kid for you to take. In Canada, we've said, like, look what we're doing. We're giving Indian and Métis kids white parents. It was the AIM program, Adopt Indian Métis. We were put into classified ads like this one. If you were to go read through the whole description on this classified ad, you'd see that they basically sell someone like Kent to a potential foster family who, if they wanted to, could go on to officially adopt them later. But to foster them, they would be given some financial incentive, at least at first. That's not Kent, that's not Donna and Diane, that's my Uncle Perry, my Auntie Crystal, my Auntie Carmen. My mom and all her 9 siblings, all 10 of them, were in these ads and split up across the country. And I have no one better than my mom to just tell you something about this. These are her words. As one of the 20,000 Indigenous children who were removed from their homes and families during a period known as the 60s Scoop, I spent a significant portion of my childhood in 7 foster homes. The myriad of experiences I had while in care include various forms of abuse, leaving unforgettable legacies of pain, hurt, and trauma. Those experiences are from my past and do not make up the primary narrative of my current life. While I am proud to have survived this time, I am not fond of that title since my experiences are in the past. Reflecting on what I have been through, however, makes me realize that my traumatic past is the catalyst that has allowed me to recognize and create the greatest joys and blessings of my life. The pain of losing connection with my family helped fuel my desire to reestablish it. At a young age, I made a vow that I was going to be a mom and that I would make sure my children would never know what it was like to experience a childhood like mine. The desire to be a mother was such an intense dream for me that it trumped anything else I could ever think of for my future. I realized even then that the yearning to create a family of my own was a manifestation of what I had lost as a child. Thankfully, I met a man whose family values closely aligned with mine. I basked in the joys of raising our family and stayed focused on creating a happy childhood for them. Everything I had lost in childhood stood in such stark contrast to what I gained as a mom. I relished in each stage of growth with my children, and I never wished for a particular stage to pass by quickly. The most positive outcome of my greatest childhood pain was that I received a new vision, an intense desire, and hyper-awareness of being able to give my family the complete opposite of my own experience. When my mother was asked what those key factors were in getting her to a place where she now felt grateful or wisdom versus resentment, she responded with, "The first thing that comes to mind in terms of what has brought me to the place I am now is being able to have my own family. As I shared in my story, the fact that I could have my very own family to love was in itself my joyful new beginning. And it simply drowned out any sense of loss or self-pity I may have continued to feel otherwise. The second factor that has brought me to where I am now is that early on in life, I developed the ability to conquer my fears. Before I was taken to care the first time, my home was a one-room granary. The children range in age from about 3 to 11 years old. I was 4. Except for the baby in the hammock, we were all lined up sideways on the bed. I remember one night the door latch had lifted due to the stormy conditions outside, and the door itself was swinging back and forth, banging repeatedly in the wind. There was no electricity, and the night was cold and pitch black with scary noises coming from outside. Neither of my older brothers would get up and close the door, and I too was scared to death of what possibly could be out there. Nevertheless, I threw off the covers and marched over, grabbed the door, and hooked it in place. From an early age, I developed an ability to face and conquer my fears, no matter how big or how small. Much later, when my two oldest children were in school, I had contemplated going to university. I knew I was capable of putting in the effort to succeed, but I greatly feared failure. It was so overwhelming that I would have dreams about the professor somehow speaking an unrecognizable language, with me being the only one who could not understand what they were saying. The more I thought about wanting to do it, the more I knew I simply had to get up and go secure that door again. My intuition was also telling me to overcome my fears. One day there was a country music video on TV about a mom who goes back to school, and despite some of the challenges with having a young family, she feels so much pride in her achievement. Seeing the video and hearing the song inspired me greatly. I wanted that too, and it fit with my desire to be at home still as much as possible. Overcoming my intense fear of failure at university not only allowed me to gain a valuable education, but it also gave me knowledge in order to reconcile my past with my newfound understanding about the colonial experience in Canada. I had carried a lot of shame about who I was, and these ideas were often a reflection of what I had noticed in the world around me. However, through my university education, I gained important insight into the history of Canadian Indigenous relations and the history of child welfare practices. I've gained a sense of pride and understanding about my Soto background and my family and cultural history, and it thrills me to be able to teach and speak about these issues today. The nature of my experiences created an array of challenges, a few of which I've shared here. While I don't hold the patent on this knowledge, I've gained some insight into how the fear of both real and imagined consequences can paralyze our decisions or prevent us from taking risks that carry the potential for life-changing outcomes. In being able to look back on what I have learned, I strongly believe that facing fears, making difficult decisions, or dealing with a specific challenge in life is infinitely more rewarding and less painful than the outcome or regret of not facing them. Those experiences help to teach me that even if there are other people who hold power over me during the course of my life, I always hold the power to change those circumstances. Those are the words from my mom. She later did reconnect with all her siblings. One of them had unfortunately died by the point of this photo. The other one, he's really hard to track down, so we weren't able to get him to this particular event. But everything that my mom shared about that fear, about living through these horrific experiences, the things that made her not feel like she had a place in this world, the things that she never wanted to experience again, somehow, I don't know how, but she ran away when she was 12 from those foster care experiences and continued to reflect on things like this. Her master's degree thesis said, "Deconstructing the 60s Scoop, Positive Experiences in Foster Care." Who writes about that after they lived through that? But she acknowledged the catastrophically horrific policy that was the 60s Scoop, but still highlighted that some stories were made better. She focused on the positive all the time. She turned pain and trauma and fear into something that was going to change the lives for others. What a better lesson for me to do. All of those things that made me feel so not seen, my queerness, two-spiritness, indigeneity, disability, I just wanted to completely withdraw. But learning from people like my mom, it became exactly the opposite. Go in the spotlight, People need to see that. They need to hear that. Healthcare practitioners, students, pre and post licensure, pharmacy students, many others need to hear that. I'm glad that you still got a chance to see or hear words from my mom, but she died just over 2 years ago. My worst fear came true. And, you know, I never saw me being happy whatsoever. I never saw me being happy at all after losing my mom. But the opposite has become true. I have never been more happy in my entire life than I am right now, to the point where, and this is kind of sad, I started to worry that I might have a brain tumor, pushing out too much serotonin or something, because this was unnatural. I was like, do people live this happy? Do people not live in constant fear of their intersecting identities and fitting in and how they're going to be seen and perceived? Like, what? Do people just go to a concert and enjoy the music? Because when I just went to Lady Gaga twice, I cried the whole time. I was just trembling. It was the most like affirming experience I have had in the recent past of being an out person in an environment that is so affirming and celebratory of difference. And again, I was like, do people experience this all the time? Do you feel this in the classroom? Do you feel this grocery shopping? Because all of those things, I just think about the things I need to do so that I'm not like spit on or kicked or yelled at, right? It's unbelievable, but I learned that all from my mom, and she continues to teach people. In fact, you heard her exact words. She was so proud of being a mom of her kids. She had this really crappy plaque that I think one of us bought her from a garage sale one day, but it became the back of her tombstone, and she requested this. My life, my joys, my pleasures, my hopes, my dreams, my treasures, my greatest loves, my very best work, my most cherished gifts to the world, my children. She felt very confident that we would each in our own paths go do something to turn her and her lineage's family trauma, experiences of difference and isolation, and our own into something that people could learn from. And you can only learn from it when you hear someone's story. My being here is entirely because of the sacrifices, strength, determination, grit, and love of so many who came before me. It's their work. It's my mom's work and my dad's, but really my mom's. It's my responsibility. I have to. In fact, my name, White Eagle, has a lot of responsibility. The eagle flies higher than all other creatures. And so the eagle has a responsibility to watch the world below, like what's needed, what's going on. And I'm going to carry message to and from Creator, the spirit world, to make sure that spirit world and creation below has what it needs. So I feel like I need to keep tabs on things that are going on and what's needed. What should I ask for help for? What's my role in all of this? This country and the people in it did not even see or define my ancestors as people until 1951. In fact, the definition of a person was anyone other than an Indian or the Indian Act. My family line resisted and persisted so that someone like me could even be here, so that someone like me could pursue post-secondary education, so that someone like me could enter spaces and places like this one, this university, any university. We're not made for, with, or by people like me. And so that someone like me might be heard. I knew really early on, watching my mom go through university, when I was in grade 3, that's when she started, which she was mentioned in that excerpt. I literally went to class with her. Like, she took a lot of night classes because she wanted to be home during the day with us, but I just went with her. I grew up looking at the effects of education and what that translates to. And I understood even then that, you know, I think I need to get those degrees. I think I need to get those letters behind my name because I'm not sure someone's going to believe me or listen or even invite me without them. So I think about, there's a reason I'm here and not my cousin Jake, my cousin Nikki, my cousin Jeremy, my cousin Tamara, my auntie Penny, my auntie Carla. They didn't have that opportunity. I did, because my mom was so damn strong at age 12 that she ran away thinking about me in 2025, of what I might be able to achieve or my sisters might be able to achieve if she did those things. So it's my responsibility. Oh, thank you. The legacy of the past and continued policies, practices, and treatment of Indigenous peoples have left us with dramatic gaps in the social determinants of health and in the health and wellness achievements of Indigenous versus non-Indigenous people. Through storytelling, here are some of those intersecting identities and how they shaped my experience. This is not as big as the first part, let me tell you, and just a few fundamental teachings that I will leave with you as you depart from here and see how this ripple effect of my mom can continue to translate even through all of you. I mentioned that just acknowledging the current state of Indigenous people's health being a direct result of Canadian government policies is what we're asking for. We're asking for it. But even if a government person admits that or says that, which they did, by the way, that needs to translate to every human being in Canada elsewhere, every elementary, high school classroom, university classroom, dinner table, coffee line, all of the things that needs to be replicated and understood by everybody. Because how are we going to get forward if there's blame pointed to Indigenous folks and not the people who put us there and the policies who put us there? So I wanted to interrupt that child welfare system that made a world for my mom and her siblings in the way that you just exactly heard it. In Saskatoon, I was an HIV clinical pharmacist in the hospital, and I saw what was happening to people, particularly pregnant patients. Every pregnant person's baby was apprehended. If they were HIV positive or very high risk of HIV, like using substances, for example, all of them were apprehended. All of the folks who were living with HIV who needed months worth of antibiotics didn't have a home to get home IV therapy, so they stayed in the hospital for 2 months, if they actually did stay, because people really did not give them any kind of attention. So a bunch of us, just random people, came together and like literally built a house, in fact, two houses, Sanctum and Sanctum 1.5. This one's for people living with HIV. This one, the 1.5, is baby. So for pregnant folks who go there 6 months prepartum and stay 3 months postpartum, there have been over 300 babies born during the lifespan so far of Sanctum 1.5, and only one has been apprehended because that's what that family wanted. All 300 of those babies would have gone into the system like my mom and all her siblings. This was one way that through her strength, resilience, and determination that I could maybe help shape healthcare and the healthcare experiences of many others. And I think that this model will be replicated and already has been across the country. Montreal Lake, Cree Nation, climate change, disasters, fire evacuations. We are the most susceptible to being evacuated from our communities during forest fires. And the community of Montreal Lake Cree Nation, when they were evacuated from their community and split between Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, and Meadow Lake, after they all went back home, over 50% of the community was using crystal meth. Whereas the day before they were evacuated, perhaps nobody. If you think about, okay, the forest fire, the evacuation, go behind that, climate change, what's contributed to climate change, colonialism and like resource extraction, all of this again. But yet we're blamed for having all these addictions. And then when we're under the influence of crystal meth, committing a crime, and how dare you, right? Versus drawing that very clear line to previous and Canadian government policies. But this community used that and did something about it. They created the very first crystal meth detox facility in their community, which hadn't existed in Canada until that point. This last part of the chapter is much better. Here I am in Toronto now, not physically right now. This is Kingston, I appreciate that. Finally finished my PhD because I understood that the world didn't want me as a pharmacist. Nobody ever wanted me as a pharmacist. I thought I'd be able to be a pharmacist and an HIV pharmacist like anyone else, but because I've occupied these various intersecting identities, particularly indigeneity in pharmacy, that's what people wanted. And I got really resentful about that for quite some time. Like, then why did I do all these degrees? You don't think I'm smart. I came up with all these narratives in my mind, but now I appreciate, oh, because you're not getting this from anybody else. There's nobody else. So if not me, who? At least in pharmacy. There's so many folks doing this work and have been for a very long time. But in pharmacy, I didn't know what else to do other than be the indigenous person they needed me to be. So that became my PhD study, which you heard was immediately changed policy. We never had any mandatory minimum requirements for indigenous education in pharmacy in Canada until my PhD was published, and they asked me about it, and we have a whole bunch of accreditation standards now. They started out really weak, like students should learn about XYZ, whereas the rest of the topic said there must be appropriate depth, breadth, scope, time spent on diabetes and whatever. I'm like, okay, well, use that language for indigenous health too, and colonialism and anti-oppression and all that. So they did. And now we have to do it. But now guess where every faculty is coming to? So I'm very busy and super elite with Air Canada. This journey of walking into happiness now and changing things has changed me in ways I never knew were possible. I spent so much time and effort trying to hide in the shadows, wearing black on black on black on black, not putting myself out there in any way. But then one friend of mine said, you know, I think that your story is perfect for this makeover episode. And first I was like, how dare you? But secondly, thank you. I really do need that. So I was on a TV show to get a makeover, which was really cool. I became a drag queen. What? For someone who didn't even want to look at a drag queen before, because it might mean that I'd be outed, to now being on the stage, looking like this fabulous person she is. And I created her for academia because I felt, you know what, I need to continue on this path of doing something in spaces that doesn't already exist. So we have drag queens at drag bars. What else am I going to add to the picture if I'm a drag queen at a drag bar? I think I need to be a drag queen in the university. I think I need to be a drag queen clinician. I think I need to be a drag queen conference presenter. So that's exactly who she is. She's doing drag story time with the chronic pain clinic at SickKids Hospital, doing pain assessments pre and post drag story time, studying the impact and effectiveness of drag-initiated outreach for HIV prevention and STI prevention and education. I'm splitting up half of my pharmacy students to learn to teach them a topic as PRIS, like STIs or HIV prevention. 2 days later, I get the other half teaching them as JARIS. But at the end of the lecture for each group, they're getting the same quiz, and I'm repeating that quiz again 2 months later and testing my theory that I think those who learn from PRIS will have far more engagement, they'll perform better academically, and in the context of pharmacy, maybe that means better patient care. The subtext of all of that is bashing the haters, right? Drag queens have been just the victim of so much unnecessary drama. It's unbelievable and another story for another day. But her debut was in Glasgow, Scotland in June at the International Symposium for Pediatric Pain, where I refused to hold a regular academic symposium talk. And I asked, can I make this a talk show instead? And so we called it Pain and Pride, hosted by Pris. And I had signs of like applause, like snap for affirmation when you really love what someone has to say, laugh, and all of those things. It was transformational for me and for so many in the audience. There were several gay, trans, queer identified people who came up to me either right away or in private and said that it changed the trajectory of their career in that moment. Because they, like me, didn't ever see someone in their career path or their field exhibit these identities and in such a positive spotlight. So she's gonna keep going, and you can follow her on Instagram. This is how it relates to you. If you are a non-Indigenous person, even if you are, and thinking about healthcare, if you're a healthcare provider, student, or already a provider, just a human being, think about a customs example. So probably most of you have been through customs. I'm going to make that assumption. Maybe some of you haven't, but those of you who haven't probably have heard stories. So when you're waiting in line to talk to a customs agent, are you like standing there like, ooh, like can't wait for this discussion? No, you probably aren't excited at all. You're probably like rehearsing, okay, where am I going? Okay, yeah, to Quebec City, or okay, for how many days? Four, five, per conference? Yes. Are any of these days personal? Who am I going with? Okay, they're going to be probably rude with me. when they're looking at my passport, am I going to look at them in the eye, or does that look suspicious? Am I going to look away? Am I going to act like nonchalant? You're making all these decisions about what your interaction is going to look like. You've made decisions about what they're going to be like and what the situation is going to be like, and you don't know anything about them. Their name, absolutely nothing. We all do this. But unfortunately, we kind of need an example to remind us of that, because we often reach a block when Indigenous, Two-Spirit, trans, queer, whomever identity you have, access healthcare, and something happens where they now kind of shut off. The provider sometimes says, like, oh, well, like, oh, no, I'm not racist, or, and here's all the reasons why I'm not racist, or no, I'm not homophobic. And we get into an interaction about telling the person about all the things we're not, right? It's not about you. In the same way that that person, this isn't about them. Everything that was going on in your mind is not about them. But they're going to receive it. And then some of what they receive, they might think is about you. So what does that mean in healthcare? All the things people are telling themselves when they go to talk to you as a researcher, as a clinician, as a person in a coffee shop. They're basing that experience on prior experiences that looked exactly like that. So I don't blame them for that. So your job, our job, my job is to just be the customs agent who's amazing. You don't need to give a lecture on why or not this, this, and that. Just be awesome. Change that story. Be curious. Establish and continue to nurture relationships. Promote Indigenous healing practices, sweat lodges, pipe ceremony, dance, song, reconnecting with family. Do the Kairos blanket exercise. There's beautiful story woven into that interactive exercise where you're literally standing on blankets and reading cue cards about pieces of Canada's history. Read and watch and listen to all of these things. You can either like take a picture or, which I can pose for, and I won't, or get these somehow somewhere later. And I always share a lot of resources on my own social media and my Linktree website. But these, I think, would be a great starting point or continuation point for us to change how healthcare and just simply existing, what that looks like and feels like for people who inhibit or employ the different intersectional identities that I do. And here's that two-pager on the myth of meritocracy. Read this book, which I have a chapter in, called White Benevolence. I wouldn't be an academic if I didn't self-promote. Read these books if you do research with and for Indigenous peoples, or maybe not with Indigenous peoples, but you want to use Indigenous research methods. There's a lot. We're not qualitative. We're not quantitative. We're Indigenous methodologies. We've always existed. We didn't need to wait for these new systems to come up to tell us what we've always been doing. We even have Indigenous statistics. So we don't sit under qual or quant. We're just our own thing, and it's legitimate. Think about data sovereignty if and when you do research. I won't say much more than that because of the diversity of folks in the room, but think about distinctions based. If you're working with First Nations, Métis, and Inuit, and you're only citing OCAP, OCAP is First Nations data governance only. There's Métis data governance, separate system, and Inuit, separate system. So think about the differences. I've even had to go back and change the title of some of my research projects because I didn't get any Inuit people registering, and I called it like Indigenous Peoples' Experiences of XYZ. So I had to change it to First Nations and Métis Peoples' Experiences of XYZ because there were no Inuit there. So think about those distinctions. Read my papers. Read my papers of people being discharged from a hospital and then going back to their reserve. There's a lot to think about. Two-Spirit people's experiences in community pharmacies. I knew that this is one of those things that I could use my story for to change the way healthcare looks for people who exhibit the same identities as me. The first and still only time Two-Spirit folks have been studied in a pharmacy setting. Indigenous methodologies, if you don't already know about it. Thinking about the tensions between Western and Indigenous worldview, although I said in pharmacy education and practice, I mean the world. I mean in healthcare. I wanted to publish it in a pharmacy journal, so I had to put that in the title. But it is not pharmacy specific whatsoever, and I think will give a lot of extra enlightenment to what we see today. A lot of this might make you feel lost, in the way I have felt lost a lot. But if you're lost in the middle of the forest like this, is the way to get to where you want to go to, like, keep standing there? No, start moving. Do something. Start running, walk, whatever. Move. You might realize that that direction was wrong. And so you'll turn around and go somewhere else. You have to do something. We all have to do something. I'm not saying, like, look at all you doing nothing and look at me doing everything. No, all of us need to do something, because we will not move forward for everybody if we just stand idle. Every time we stand idle, we're giving money into the piggy bank of the status quo, saying, you know what, I want to invest in the status quo because I like how things are. I don't want to change it. So just move. I'm leaving you with this quotation, which to me encapsulates everyone and their health being a complex story and the connection to policy and practice. Maybe pain is where language becomes physical. The integumentary system, the musculoskeletal, the lymphatic, the endocrine. If I could go back, I'd include more to the list. The economic, the racial, the gender. Say, this world is made up of systems that manage all the essential body functions. They determine what lives, what dies. Show the transcripts from legislative sessions, the comment sections, the dinner tables. Say, these are anatomy lessons. They determine what lives, what dies. One day when I die, rewind the heart attack. What power precipitated it? Unfurl the tumor. What policy prescribed it? Dissect the culture, not just my corpse. Diagnose the world. Hold one big stethoscope to its heart and listen. Is it breathing or is it weeping? Thank you for indulging me in this whole time. I so appreciate it. That's it.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Sidrovic, for a wonderful, very captivating talk. Thank you for being vulnerable. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and feelings and sharing your pain, your reflections. Thank you for sharing your teachings. I really hope that I and people listening today here and online can implement a lot of the stuff that you said. I think for us in healthcare, I think it's going to help us be better healthcare providers. And for people who are in healthcare, I think it's going to make us better human beings. And thank you for showing us the path one step closer towards reconciliation. Thank you again.
Mm-hmm. Thank you to my mom.
And I hope the impact from us carrying forward the teachings today is really going to continue that ripple effect that your mom started. So thank you.
Broadcasting live from the basement of Carruthers Hall. I say, Carruthers, are you all right down there?
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Revolving Door on CFRC 101.9 FM. My name is Liam, and this is the show where each week we talk about a different band and their influences, and eventually, who they influenced. This week is going to be a bit of a different and not entirely straightforward episode, but bear with me. Today's band that we will be talking about is called South Pacific. They're a Canadian band from Ottawa, Ontario, sort of specializing in like the noise rock, really ethereal sort of vibe they got going on, but they're really cool, and I think you'll like them. Well, also, today, we're going to be sort of drawing a roadmap of different underground music that made it possible for South Pacific to make their music. So, without further ado, let's get into it. Now, I first discovered the band South Pacific pretty recently when I was so fortunate to get to go to their show at the Mansion in downtown Kingston, celebrating 25 years of their album, Constance. It was a really incredible show, and I really just was entranced with the music the whole time. So here's one of those tracks to ease you into it.